It is now my pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Charles from Visalia with 3 years. Let's give it up for Charles.
Good evening. My name is Charles Brinson, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is 8/23/2015. I would like to congratulate everyone who took chips tonight, and I'd like to say welcome home to the newcomer. We'll love you until you love yourself. Sounds corny now, but you'll get to know it as time goes on, and you'll actually like it, and you'll say it to somebody else just like I'm saying it to you now. All right, so I was raised in an alcoholic and drug addict home. And I don't remember how old I was the first time I had a drink, because I remember, getting beer for the adults and, taking sips and the adults laughing, things like that. But I do remember my first drunk, and I was 8 years old. We were living in Arkansas, and I went down to the river with my brother and a family friend who we called Aunt Kathy. And she had a six-pack of Budweiser. They were hot. And she asked if we wanted one, and my brother said yeah, and I followed suit. And I remember that it was gross. Like, I did not like the taste of that hot Budweiser. And this was in Arkansas, so I'm pretty sure they called it near beer, so it wasn't even really that potent. Maybe that was Missouri, it was near beer. Either way, I lived in that area, but it was Arkansas when I got drunk for the first time. And but I do remember about halfway through that beer, I started feeling warm and like fuzzy and happy and light. So growing up, there was a lot of violence, either between mom and dad or family friends. There was always parties going on. There's always a card game going on, I seem to remember. And so there was always stressful moments. And I remember when I started to get that buzz, like all that stuff like went away. And I drank two, and I was having a whole lot of fun until I wasn't. And I remember on the way home, my mom was mad at my Aunt Kathy. My Uncle Don was in the back seat laughing. I was sitting in the front seat trying to squirt lime juice in my mouth and getting everybody in the eyes. And I thought that was funny. And then all of a sudden I got sick and I had to throw up. And I remember it was dark and we pulled over and I just started throwing up. I don't remember stopping throwing up, but obviously I did because I'm standing here talking. But so that was my first drunk. That was my first experience. And even though I got sick, a little over a year later, I remember a traumatic incident happened in my life. And I remember that feeling down by the river. And I remembered that, I felt safe and I felt light. And so I started to like chase that because it was it made me feel good. And then by the time I was 10, maybe 11, most likely 11, it was, drinking and smoking and doing the things that I shouldn't be doing as often as I could be doing them. And always hung out with older people, so I wanted to be cool and I wanted to fit in. And drinking and drugging was definitely a way to do that in the neighborhood I grew up in. I got first introduced to AA about the time I was 12 when my parents got us back from CPS. So my brother and I turned ourselves into CPS because we were tired of being hungry. And we were tired of people breaking our windows looking for mom and dad, that they had burned them and things like that. And so when my parents did get us back, they were in the program. And I resented the program. Like, I didn't like you guys. Because my parents wanted me to stop doing what I was, in my mind, raised to do, which was to drink and party. And I wasn't having that. And then they went off and became ordained ministers. And so there went my whole fucking religious idea. Like, that was not cool. I'm moving this because it's, like, right in my eyesight, dude. Like, it's, like, right there. So that was my first introduction to AA, right after my parents got us back from CPS. I do remember going to a lot of meetings with my mom before she actually got us back, like on some of our visits and stuff. We'd ride the bikes all around town, and I guess I thought that was cool, but sitting in the meeting was boring. So we didn't have, you know, iPads and tablets and stuff like all my nieces and nephews and kids do nowadays. So, you know, we had twiddle your thumbs and keep your mouth shut for entertainment. It was great. You know, so my drinking career just continued to progress from there. Like, I became more rebellious. You know, I snuck out of the house. You know, I stole cars. I got my first GTA when I was 13. And it was a four-wheeler. It wasn't even a cool car or nothing. But I was drunk when I stole it. You know, I continued to drink. I ended up, you know, going to juvie in and out a few times. A couple group homes. The first one, I stole their car and drove to Santa Cruz. And the second one, they asked me, are you going to steal our car? And I said no. And I graduated that group home. But on my weekend passes, I would huff propane because you couldn't test for that. And that's all I got to say about that because that's an outside issue. But it just continued to progress, and all the way up into my adulthood. My son was born when I was 22 years old. By the time I was 24, his mom had enough of me and my drinking and moved him and my son and her other son up to Oregon. And I quit drinking for a year. Like, I didn't go to meetings. I just quit drinking, you know, and I talked her into letting me move up there. And she did. She let me move up there. And it was maybe, I don't know, I'd say maybe 3 months after I got up there. You know, I joined the fire department. It was a local volunteer fire department. And I wasn't working yet, so I was just sitting at home. Everybody was gone. And I was like, you know, beer sounds really good right now. I was like, I'll go get a Mike's Hard Lemonade. Then I'll only need one. And I got a 16-ounce because, you know, I didn't want to get too messed up. And it had been a while since I drank. So I got one, and, man, I played it off really good. Like, I was proud of myself. I was. I was like, she got home. Everything was great. Like, I even cooked dinner. Like, it was good. And so a couple days later, I was like, well, you know, I did that so well. I can have two. And I stayed with the 16-ouncers because I didn't want to overdo it. Which was great. I handled that one really good too. So the next time, which was maybe 2 days later, it was like, I can definitely have more. So this time I bought a tall can and two of those 16-ouncers. And it just so happened that my neighbor was smoking, you know, some stuff over the fence. And I was like, wow, that smells really good. I was like, I could probably do that too since I handled all this other stuff so well. And it was the night that my stepson had a concert recital. Well, needless to say, I stayed at home with the toilet while they went to the recital because I had overdone it. And I don't know if any of you can relate to overdoing it or not drinking for a while and then going back out thinking one or two is going to be okay. But for me, it led right back into drinking daily. So once I got in trouble for being too hammered to go to my stepson's recital, I thought, well, fuck it. Covers are blown. So I just went right back to drinking. And it wasn't long that I was back to drinking a 30-pack a day by myself, and that was faithfully. The bills got paid, and then the beer got bought, and then if there was anything else left, I spent that too. Because I'm a very selfish, self-centered person, especially when I add alcohol into the mix, you know. I remember going on fire calls drunk. And I was an engine operator. We did structure fire, and the rig I drove had a 2,200-gallon water tank, so it wasn't very light of a piece of equipment. And I remember waking up in the middle of a fire sometimes, like hosing down a living room or something, and I'm like, whoa. Later on, I learned from my sponsor that normal people don't do that. That was on step one, you know, the whole admitting we're alcoholic, right? And I was like, yeah, I'm totally an alcoholic. I get it. And he's like, well, let me ask you a few things. And so that was one of the questions. And that was when I was told that normal people don't act that way. So my drinking actually ended up I was able to go and do some state time for about 19 months, where, you know, I got three hot meals and a roof over my head, and I didn't really have any responsibilities. But I did wake up after I did come to in county jail, and was like, why am I here? And my thought was, you know, because I'm selfish and self-centered and conceited, I was like, well, fuck, I'm a firefighter. Why am I in jail? I was like, I know I didn't drive last night because I didn't want another DUI, so I walked back to the store to get beer. And then I remembered, instead of going to the store, I ended up in the bar, where I apparently drank in a very short period of time, by myself, and I didn't buy anybody any rounds, but I dropped $120 in an hour, which isn't a whole lot in a bar, but I do remember that I was drinking Jaeger bombs, and I know that those things and I don't get along too well from past experiences down in Bakersfield when I got escorted to the Bakersfield city limits. And well, they didn't tell me not to come back, but they said that if I didn't do that, that I was going to jail. So I went home. I actually called a buddy, and he came and got me, and they followed us out. But so my first experience, my first good experience with AA was in prison. And it was an ulterior motive for me to go to AA meetings in prison, because it would look really good when I got out that I had been attending these AA meetings and attending all these self-help classes. And so that was my motive for going to AA. But then something happened. Like, so you guys know that pink can that goes around H&I, that's hospitals and institutions. Well, prison is an institution, and they do go in there, believe it or not. And these guys drove. I was in Deer Ridge Correctional Facility up in Oregon. I don't remember the town, but I know they drove an hour and a half every Sunday, and they were there faithfully. One guy in particular never missed a meeting in my whole time there. But so that was my first experience of like AA and H&I and then being there for you. So when I got released, the week before I got released, one of the guys in H&I said, hey, found out that I was going to have a 4-hour layover in Salem. And he said, hey, I want to have a guy meet you there, you know, so you're not alone. I was like, all right, cool. So this guy that I'd never met me at the bus station, took me to breakfast, and then took me to a noon meeting before I got on the bus to go, you know, home and go on my journey. And I thought that was really cool, because H&I is definitely a good thing. So if you see that pink can, you think, oh, pink, that's not cool. Well, the color might not be cool, but what they do and their purpose is definitely cool, because it definitely helped put something into my brain that stuck. Now, I'd like to say that I have 5 years clean and sober, but that's not the case, because relapse is a part of my recovery. It doesn't have to be a part of your recovery, and it doesn't say in the big book that it's a part of recovery, but it is a part of my recovery. And it started with something I'm sure you all have heard of. It started with a resentment. And I got a call that my son's mother had passed away, and I had commitments in a meeting that I was going to, and I called the guy, I called my sponsor, and I was like, hey man, you know, I got my son now, and I don't have any child care, so, you know, I'm going to have to drop my commitment, and, you know, I just can't do it, you know, I don't really want to bring my son, you know, around you guys, which is me. I guess I didn't want him around me. But the bottom line is, he said, you know, I'm not going to tell you how to do your program, but I will warn you that if you stop going to meetings, and then if you stop being of service, chances are you're going to go back out and drink. And I got mad, and I didn't call him anymore, and I didn't go to meetings anymore. And I was dating a girl who drank every day, and one night I took a drink of what she had. And that was on a Tuesday night, I believe. And then that next weekend, I drank a fifth of Crown Royal by myself. And I remember calling my brother over the phone, because I was still on parole and I was still on post-prison supervision. And I was like, dude, like, is this going to come out by Monday? You know, because I got a test. And he was like, well, did you smoke anything? And I was like, no, I did, bro. I smoked. and I was tripping, you know, but they didn't test me. It did come out in the wash later because I had rented an apartment from some people and I drank with them and they videoed it. And then when I moved out, they wanted me to pay double of what they said I owed them, and I didn't. They said, well, we're going to tell your parole officer. So I did one better and went and told my parole officer. I said, hey, I fucked up. And I got drunk, and it worked. I didn't get a violation, and I didn't pay them what they said I owed them. I did do some step work on that because I wanted to make sure that my side of the street was clean. So I went over the bills, went over them with my sponsor, and I was right, which is great because I like being right. So I went back to drinking, and it was you know, trying to evade the parole and probation. I knew they weren't in on Friday, so I could drink Thursday night and make it until Monday check-in and test clean if I had to. I did that for quite a while. And then my last drink was August 22nd, 2015. It was on a Saturday, and it was at my boss's wedding. And I did what I normally do. You know, I started out drinking a couple beers and was like, this is going great. It's time for some hard liquor. Oh, this is going great. It's time for a cigar. Wow, this is really cool. And then so like I was the only one paying attention to the kids, maybe because I'm a big kid. So we're all playing like this army game and I'm jumping over these wedding tables and knocking chairs down. And I'm just having a blast. And like the kids are having a blast. So, you know, still in my mind, it's all manageable and I'm doing great. And then once again, I overdid it. Overdoing it, getting sick, or, you know, drinking, throwing up, drinking more, never changed, you know, the headaches the next day, never changed my thought on it'll be different next time. Because I continued to do it and it was always the same outcome. But so I remember I was ready to pass out. And I was spinning, and my son was ready to go to bed. I don't know where he went, but he was ready to go to bed, and we're at my boss's house, and I didn't know which room was his, but I know that there was this room right next to the sliding back door, and I said, all right, son, we're going to sleep right here. And then this guy walks through, and it was actually my boss, but it was dark. He's like, I don't know whose bed this is, but we're sleeping in it. He goes, well, it's mine, but that's okay. I'll sleep in the guest room. I'm like, oh, that's good. And I'm drunk, you know, and you know, it was crazy. So I lay down on the bed, you know, and I'm like, man, I'm spinning. So I put one foot on the ground and I'm like, wow, I'm really still spinning. This ain't cool. So I do what I normally do. I'm like, all right, well, let's just go get her done. So I went in the bathroom and I stuck my finger down my throat and I started yakking. And I'm sitting there and I'm throwing up. And the bathroom is in the master bedroom. So I can see the bed and I can see my son. And I had my aha moment. And if you stick around long enough, you'll hear that term more than once if you haven't already heard it again. But I had my aha moment. And I was like, there's my son. Here I am. I'm on parole. I'm on post-prison supervision. I still had like 5.5, 6 months hanging over my head. My son's mom passed away. I'm his only parent. Like, what in the are you doing? You know, that was my aha moment. And I had been going to church because the chaplain that brought in, you know, Bible studies to the jail, him and I stayed in contact the whole time I was in prison. And you know, we became really good friends. I'm still in contact with him today. And I was meeting with him once a week at the library, and we still did our little discipleship study. It was great. And he said, you know, I know this girl that I think you'd really like. And she gave me her number for you to call her. And I was like, well, I didn't call her for like a week and a half because the last relationship I'd got into didn't work out so great. And I wasn't ready, you know. And I was talking to her, though. I finally called her. I was talking to her. And we were supposed to have ice cream one day, and she texts me and says, sorry, I can't make it. And I'm like, all right, cool, I got blown off. Well, then she texts me later and is like, so, you know, I'm in recovery, and I had to meet with my sponsor. I was like, oh, I'm in recovery too, which I wasn't, but, you know, I knew about it. And so we're talking to like midnight, 2 o'clock in the morning, and I'm outside drinking a beer, looking at the stars, and I'm telling her, wow, do you see that star right there? And she she's 30 minutes away in the next town. I'm like, this is really cool. So she told me before I went to that wedding that if I needed to talk, to call her, because she knew there was going to be alcohol around, and she was actually working a program, so she knew the dangers of, you know, going around a bunch of people drinking. I called her the next day, not the day of, but I called her the next day and said, hey, I relapsed, but the truth is I was, you know, still drinking, which I did actually tell her that later on. The first impression I gave you was a fucking lie, shocker. I called her and she said, well, you want to go to a meeting with me on Tuesday? I'm like, yeah, cool, because up there in Gold Beach and Brookings, pretty selective on what meetings are available. So I went to a meeting. It was at St. Timmy's. It was Tuesday night. And it was at 7 o'clock, and I stood up and I said, my name's Charles. I didn't say my last name yet until I learned about that down here when I moved. Because I'm not breaking any anonymity but my own, and I want everybody to know who I am in case I get hurt, you know. There's more than one Charles B. in this world, I'm sure. But anyhow, I went to this meeting. I stood up. I admitted that I was an alcoholic. I said I had less than 30 days, I think. So I had like 3 days. And after the meeting, a guy walked up to me, and he said, hey. He told me his name. I said, hey. He goes, are you done drinking? And I'm like, yeah. Oh, and this is another part. I got to back up just a little bit. So this girl that I've been talking to at church, asked me if I'd done my steps yet. And I said, no, I haven't done them yet. And I told her I wanted to date her. And she said, well, I don't want to date you until you're done with your steps. You know, it's like they talk about in your first year of recovery not to date. It's not in the big book, but it is a pretty good suggestion. If anyone suggests it to you, give it some thought. Because you're going to be a different person a year after you come in than you were when you first got here. You think a whole lot differently. Hopefully less twisted. So I was wanting to impress her, and I said, yeah, I'm done drinking. You know, she's standing right next to me. Yeah, I'm done drinking. He says, oh, okay. Do you have a sponsor? I said, no. He said, you want to work the steps? I was like, yeah, absolutely. He goes, give me your number. He didn't give me his. He asked me for mine, and I did. I gave him my number, and the next day we started on step one, and that's when I found out that my life was unmanageable, that I am an alcoholic, and that I did stuff that normal people don't do, like on a daily basis. And it didn't matter who was there or what the consequences were. You know, I did whatever it took to get drunk. And I didn't drink socially, except for maybe that first time, even though I got drunk. But my goal when I drank was to get shit-faced, was to either black out, pass out, or not remember. And that's how I drank up until I was 28 years old. I drank like that every day. So I was there to impress a girl. Now, I'll tell you this. Me and the girl aren't together anymore, but I still have the same sobriety date. So this program does work. It doesn't necessarily work on all your relationships, but it will definitely help you build stronger, better, and more viable relationships. So, my note says, what have I done to stay sober? Well, the first thing I do is I wake up in the morning and I say a little something to my dude, my higher power. It's a little bit less than when I first got sober and first got into the whole morning meditation. Life does happen. But I know that if I don't start my day like that, the rest of it's going to be messed up. Like, really messed up. And I haven't taken a drink. And I did something I never did before. I picked up my phone and I made phone calls when I'm messed up in the head. Sometimes it's a simple text message. Sometimes it's a call. And I've actually called right after I turned a year sober. I moved from Gold Beach to Portland, and I still had the same sponsor, and he said, he put me on this challenge. He said, I want you to call 5 different people from your phone list that you're getting up there every day and ask them how their day's doing. Don't tell them anything about yours unless they ask you first. I started doing that, and it made the phone become lighter, like it really did. Because I know the first time when I was struggling and I made that first phone call to another member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was like, that phone was heavy. It was like back in the day, it was almost like the old rotary phone. You know, you had to pick it up. It had a cord on it, but it didn't. It was a cell phone, and it was actually a smartphone, but it was heavy. And it's really not. It's a whole psychological thing that we do to ourselves. And then I worked the steps. Now, the first time, when I first started working the steps with the sponsor I got after I relapsed, I was really trying to rush through them because I was like, all right, as soon as I get done with these steps, I'm going to get the girl, and it's going to happen. And by the time I got to my fourth step, you know, we went over it. There was only six things on my fourth step, by the way. Six, that's it. He looked at me and said, okay. He said, well, let's go over them. He never once told me that I was full of crap. But he did start to ask me questions about the things I had written down. And I messed up and I became honest. And what happened with that old honesty thing was I found out I got a lot more stuff that needs to be on this list. So I went and I redid it. And as soon as I redid it and actually did a thorough inventory and actually did a thorough fourth step and went over it with him, the obsession to drink left. Now, it didn't leave like, okay, you know, I messed up. I'm mad at Bob because, you know, he stole my girl. No, it didn't happen like that. What happened was like a couple days, I guess, had gone by that I wasn't obsessing about drinking. And I woke up and I was like, wow, I didn't think about drinking yesterday. So that for me was shortly after my fourth step. And that's when the obsession to drink was gone. Does that mean I don't and haven't ever thought about drinking again? No. No, because that happens. You know, it's the Central Valley. It's fucking hot. Who doesn't want a cold beer on a hot day after you get off, you know, get off work doing a roof job or something? I mean, yeah, it sounds good. But the only problem with that is it only sounds good until I start thinking about what's going to happen after I take that first drink. And the truth about that is I don't know exactly what's going to happen after I take that first drink. You know? And I'm not willing to risk what I have today. You know, I can drink some water, and it's just as good. It's just as refreshing. I've also gotten involved in service work. I spoke at the first annual corrections conventions for Alcoholics Anonymous in Salem, Oregon. Was with the same group of guys that were bringing the meetings into the institution I was at. I was the keynote speaker, and I was nervous, and it was great. It was a great experience. Luckily, there was only about 200 people there, so it wasn't too bad. But service work. So I'm involved in a committee. It's called Tuffy Paul, which is Tulare United Fresno Young People and Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a mouthful, but if you just say Tuffy Paul, it sounds really cool. And our logo is knuckles, because we're tough. You know, I'm a treasurer at a meeting on Tuesday nights, and when people ask me to speak, if I'm physically capable of doing it, I don't say no. You know, it's pretty simple for me today as to what I need to do. I need to give away what was given to me. That's another thing you're going to hear. Give away what was freely given to you. And a lot of these things are going to sound super corny when you're fresh, but I tell you what, they may save your life if you stick around, if you give yourself a chance, if you give this program a chance. You know, service work can be something as simple as washing coffee cups. I went up to San Francisco this weekend, and they use real coffee cups still up there. And they asked if anybody was willing to wash them. I raised my hand, and I washed coffee cups. It was great. Like, I haven't washed other people's dishes in a very long time. And you would think that that's not cool, but I tell you what, I felt good about it. You know, I didn't break a cup, but the guy behind me did, so it's cool. He actually hit it off the counter. I tried saving it, but it was too far gone. So, life today. Let's see if I can wrap this up in 10 minutes. I think I can. Life today is pretty good. I've learned a lot. I have a lot more to learn. I don't know, we didn't read chapter 5. Did we read chapter 5 here? No? Okay, so chapter 5 is how it works. And there's a part in it that says we are not saints, and I usually say something obnoxious like, what's the point, right after that. And then following what's the point is that we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. That's it. Just be willing to grow. Be willing. Be willing to be willing if you're not willing. Be willing to be willing to be willing if it takes that many willingnesses to get you to be willing. I mean, whatever it takes. But be willing to grow along spiritual lines. And for me, what that means is that I don't have all the answers. I don't have it all figured out. I'm willing to learn. I'm willing to admit if I'm wrong. I'm willing to ask someone who may have been through a situation that I'm going through now if they have any advice. I call my sponsor. So today I have the opportunity to pay my bills. I have the opportunity to work when I need it. I have the opportunity to further my education, which I am currently doing. I have the opportunity to be a father. I have the opportunity to be a friend. I have what we call Cadillac problems these days. And I don't remember who I learned that from. I think it was from my brother. But so I have... It depends on the day and depends on the mood. It's what vehicle do I take? Now, mind you, I'm not rich. I don't make a lot of money. But I do have 5 different vehicles. And my nephew said, you know, Uncle, for someone who's middle class, you sure do have a lot of cars. And I said, nephew, I'm lower class. I'm like below lower class. But, you know, I buy things used and I fix them up. You know, if they need paint, I paint it myself. But those are the opportunities I have today. Those are the problems I have. It's like, what car do I want to take today? Mostly in the summertime, now that I have a car with air conditioning, it's that one. You know, it really is, to be honest. I have a family who can depend on me. I have friends that can call on me. You know, I have the opportunity to... fill some pretty big shoes of my father, who just recently passed away. So my dad's been in construction his whole life, and you know, he brought us kids along and showed us a few things, and I'm grateful for that. I currently have the opportunity to take on this big, huge, never-ending remodel at my mom's house. I get to do that today, like... And it feels good to me because it's like, I know that she can count on me because today my word is good. Like, it used to not be, you know? And it's like, I can actually look in the mirror and say, I love you. I can actually stand here and say that I look in the mirror and say, I love you, Charles, and not feel all weird about it. Like, when I first said, my sponsor made me look in the mirror and say, I love you every morning. Like, for real. Like, it's all good now. Like, I'm a totally different person. So, like, you know, that's one thing that they talk about in recovery is give yourself a year in this program. Give this program a year. Don't kill yourself because you're not going to be the same person a year from now. You would be killing the wrong person if you did. You know? I have a life today, and it's because I was willing to be willing. It's because I did the best I could with working the steps. And I've worked the steps 3 times through, and I work a 10, 11, 12, and a 4, sometimes on a daily basis. I make amends promptly, you know, except when to do so would injure them or others. Sometimes I consider myself another, so, you know, I still haven't made a few amends that, you know, might land me back in prison, but I'm making a living amends, and I did write it out and read it to my sponsor, and then I burnt the evidence. So, oh shoot, this is being recorded. I forgot about that part. It's all good. Oh, and I said my last name too. It's really all good because my higher power's got it, you know what I mean? Like, he's taking care of it. It's cool. He already knew this was going to happen before it happened. You know, I'm a firm believer that whatever you put in front of recovery, you're going to lose. So that means, if you're a parent out there, that means, like, for me, I have to put recovery before my son. And when I first heard that from an old-timer, I was like, man, you're crazy. My son's got to come first. But the fact of the matter is, if I'm not sober, he ain't even going to come at all. Like, he's not going to be in the pit. He's not going to be a thought. You know, and I'm grateful for the things I've learned in recovery today. I'm grateful for the life I have, you know. And it's a life bigger than I have imagined. And if I sit down and imagine myself where I'm going to be in 5 years, like, it's pretty great. But I always get surprised when I try to imagine something that's going to happen. If I continue to keep my side of the street clean and continue to work these steps, like, it's better than I imagined. And that's crazy. And it's cool. You know, the first year of recovery is tough. The first 30 days of recovery is tough, but the next 30 days is even tougher. Because all these feelings that you've been suppressing start to come up, and then you have to deal with them. For me, drinking was only a part of my problem. The rest of it was in between my ears and above my shoulders. And working the steps and working with a sponsor, I have been able to better my way of thinking. I have been able to pause when agitated, and I have been able to pray, and I have been able to ask people for advice on situations that I first want to drop everything and say, fuck it, I'm out of here. But today I don't have to do that, you know. I still can, but I choose not to. If you're new in recovery, you know, I suggest that you get a sponsor. I suggest that you give this, you know, this deal a chance. If you're wondering if I'm full of shit, a lot of times I am. It happens. I mean, I'm human. But I'm not as much full of shit today as I was 3 years ago. And for that, I'm grateful. Give this program a chance. Introduce yourself to someone you don't know. And one thing that I have learned in recovery is that you can and will do most of your growth outside of your comfort zone. I took ballet last semester. I thought it was a different type of dance. It said contemporary dance, and I thought, all right, cool, I'm going to get to learn how to do all these different dance moves so when I, you know, meet a girl, I can go dancing with her. It was basically ballet. And I stuck with it. And there's videos on the COS website, you know. You can look it up. It's cool. We danced to Thunder, and it was great. You know what I mean? But I did learn something. I did learn that I can still accomplish things even when life is tough. Even when I don't want to do something, I can do it. You know? And you guys can too, you know? Let's see. I'd like to thank Bill Hatzman for asking me to talk tonight. He's not here, but he did call me from Utah and say, hey man, I'm not there. You're going to do great. I'll listen to you on the web. I thank you guys for listening. The last thing I want to say is, if you're new, pick a sobriety date. Make it yours. Don't let anyone or anything take it from you. With that, I'll keep coming back.